Welcome to another episode of That's So Cincinnati. Jason Williams, Sherry Coolidge, Silent Phil. We are back for another week of 2020. Our special guest today is Cincinnati School Board member Ryan Messer. We had him on last year. It's a great, great chat. And got plenty to chat with him about today. With schools back in session, him being part of the vote with all around with how to decide how to do school this year. He wrote an op-ed, a really great op-ed in the Cincinnati Inquirer for us about Tom Brenneman. We want to ask him about that. Sherry, we want to ask him, what else do we want to ask him about?
You know, I've been talking to him recently with some of these Airbnb stories where these owners are having troubles with parties and destruction of property. That's kind of been a big topic the last couple of weeks after a handyman was shot in an Airbnb. So I put that on our agenda. And I mean, I honestly, what do we have to ask him about? We got to ask him about the streetcar.
The streetcar. And yeah. he owns Airbnbs, and he's, if we go all the way back to 2013, which seems like 40 years ago, Ryan was the leader of getting community support to keep the streetcar going and rallying people to convince the council to keep it going. And so with that being back in the news again, Groundhog Day at City Hall, we'll ask Ryan about that. But before we jump over to Ryan Messer, let's first, Sherry, talk about the 10 p.m. closing of the bars. Cincinnati Police Chief Elliot Isaac brought this up in council this week, that with the uptick in violence, he's very concerned about a correlation between the early closing of bars, which was implemented by Governor Mike DeWine as an effort to try to curb the spread of COVID-19. The police chief is saying, hey, he believes that the uptick in violence in the city right now, this could be contributing to that early closing of the bars. Sherry, talk about that. What do you think? Or talk a little more about what the chief would sort of address and what went into that.
You know, it came out yesterday during Council's Law and Public Safety Committee had a hearing to deal with the violence. They heard from community leaders, a lot of people, on what needs to be done, and they heard from the chief. It was mentioned in passing that this 10 p.m. kind of last call law, which is aimed at curbing the pandemic and making sure people don't gather, has had unintended consequences. And the chief wrote a letter to Mayor John Cranley laying out his concerns about these unintended consequences. And then the mayor, in turn, agreed with the chief, and he sent it on to Governor Mike DeWine. And now this is an entire statewide 10 p.m. last call. And, you know, the governor said he would look at carving out Cincinnati, but nobody really thinks that's going to happen. But it really spurred this huge conversation yesterday about these unintended consequences. What the chief said is people, like in normal times, you know, people would go to bars and clubs and, you know, they'd stay there late. I think we all can remember maybe from our past days that people do stay out late, not me now, but and they go to these clubs, and there's a lot of rules at these clubs, which is, you know, there's metal detectors. People, you know, underage people can't get in them. There's security. Well, without those types of places, people are finding these workarounds. They're having parties at Airbnbs. They are gathering Grant Park, where we saw 10 people shot on, you know, mid-August. At the banks, we're hearing a lot of people, these large gatherings. They still want to be together. So they're skirting this 10 p.m. rule with drinking illegally, and they're carrying guns and getting in fights, and then they're shooting. So this is the chief's, you know, premise of like, look, this is what we didn't have these gatherings, this kind of violence. And he says that that's the problem here.
Oh, interesting. My question would be, so, but if you look at the uptick in violence, aren't a lot of these shootings happening in the middle of the night, basically kind of after bars would close anyway?
Well, that's and when things really get heated. Like, people are drinking. The gatherings do start earlier. And no, they're not from 10 p.m. to midnight, exactly. But they're carrying guns. The idea is, the chief's premise is, if they were in these clubs and you can't bring a gun into them, nobody's carrying weapons. So even if you get in a disagreement, you're in a disagreement. But he says things will get, when they're carrying guns at these, you know, honestly illegal gatherings, you're not allowed to have, you know, large gatherings in parks after dark. You're not allowed to have large gatherings in the pandemic, right? So these illegal gatherings, the people have guns. And so when they get in a fight, they might not be at 10, you know, they might get in a fight at 12:30 or 1 o'clock, and it's leading to shootings. Whereas if they were in these, you know, clubs where there are a set of rules, then we wouldn't have as many problems as we do with the violence. So that's really his premise. I think there's a, kind of a lot to shake out of looking at statistics and everything. But, you know, he said it in this letter. At this point, the city's asked the governor to carve us out of that. He did even note in the letter, I would say, you know, he understands, like, trying to, you know, stop the spread of the coronavirus and supports the mask mandate and supports some of these other efforts. But this is the one thing he said is unintended consequences.
Well, that really caught, I think, caught a lot of people's attention when he said that. You mentioned that they asked for the carve out from the governor's office. Any read on whether the governor's would is really taking it seriously to potentially do this? Does that become? Are other cities in Ohio experiencing? I know there's an uptick in violent crime nationwide right now, but are other cities in Ohio experiencing or early seeing some of what Chief Isaac is seeing?
So what we saw is, you know, Governor Mike DeWine, God love him, you know, a reporter asked him a question. He's like, well, we'll look into that. But our Columbus reporter, Jesse Ballmer, she said the word she is getting back is the lawyers who are looking into just like a little carve out for Hamilton County, they're skeptical. So to me, like, that's a read between the lines of like, that's a no. Like when you ask your parents and they say maybe, they really mean no.
No.
It seems like that's every answer to me. And you know, honestly, Cincinnati is alone in kind of this theory with other Ohio. You know, there's the mayors have like these regular calls with the governor, and apparently it came up in the call, and other mayors are like, no, we're going to stick to this because we think it's working. And most notably, Nan Whaley from up in Dayton is like, no, we want to keep ours, because it was kind of like, well, what does everyone else say? So it really would have to be a carve out for us. No other mayors are supporting this idea of kind of rolling it back.
Yeah, I'm gonna go with, yeah, that's unlikely to happen.
It did spur really a community conversation. Some of it was about the violence and the reasons behind it, but then other parts of the conversation are really, you know, from these bar owners and just really upset. They don't like this rule. They think it's hurting business, and they don't think it's really, you know, for the greater good, because they don't think it's working, especially if these illegal gatherings are happening in other places. They're still happening.
Yeah, and you also, as a part of that presentation the other day, Sherry talked about, and you put this out on Twitter, and you I think you alluded to the fact like it really just really humanizes the victims, and where the Cincinnati police had put a photo up of where they had all the victims in one photo. Of 68 victims of homicide this year in the city of Cincinnati, which is, unfortunately, correct me if I'm wrong, putting us on a record pace, right?
Absolutely. And it's a huge concern, which is one of the reasons why they had this hearing at City Hall. And it was really aimed at everything that can be done to reduce violence. This last call idea was one of many, many things that were discussed. I mean, they talked about hotspot policing and overtime and more police presence. They talked about what the, you know, the community leaders can be doing and how City Hall can support those community leaders. There was a lot of wide-ranging discussion of what's going to be done about this. And it was a really, really stark photo of, you know, it was like squares of each victim. And
yeah,
put together, and there was a, you know, one of the squares was angel wings. And I really paused to look at that and probably missed, you know, the next couple of things that were being said, taking that all in. And it brought it home. And honestly, you know, as of this recording, we're at 69. There was a 16-year-old killed in the early mornings of Tuesday this week.
Gosh, man. May God bless all their families. Golly, that's...
I mean, last year, the total number of homicides was 73.
For the entire year?
Yes.
Hopefully, by some miracle, somehow, some way, we don't get to that. But, man, I know that's...
You know what, Jason? It's not going to take a miracle. It's going to take some leadership. I'm interested to see what actually comes out of all of these hearings and what's being done. The chief does seem to have a plan. There weren't a lot of details. Like, it wasn't like some, you know, 25-point plan that was shared. They're working on it.
Yeah.
But I just... That's what it's really going to take. It's what it took the last time we had this large increase in violence in 2006.
Yeah.
You know, three anti-violence programs, very expensive, but started and worked on. And, you know, and the collaborative agreement, changing the way we do policing in Cincinnati, kind of came out of the riots. Like, it does take real plans and not just having discussions that it's happening.
Sure, you've been covering City Hall for a long time. You've been covering police and courts, and I mean, you've seen all angles of government and crime and police. Is there been are the experts, the folks who follow this stuff and who try to reduce violence, have they been able to really pinpoint the, you know, 1, 2, 3 reasons as to why this has been such an uptick? I know that, you know, I can sit here and you know, predict, oh, you know, hey, people have been cooped up in the stay-at-home orders and all that stuff, but that, I'm no expert. Have you heard any, like, hey, these are the I don't know, 2, 3 tangible reasons as to why we believe this is really happening?
Well, things I've heard floated out there are this large gathering premise that those are causing a lot of problems. But there's also the idea of, you know, less structure with schooling, right? And the idea of there's not an everyday look at, you know, every kid has to be in a classroom seat. And what's happening, right? There's losing track of kind of what's going on. There's, you know, everyone says, like, the rec centers and the pools, you know, keep kids busy during the summer. That's always been a thing, right? Well, that's not the same this summer. And I think, you know, it's not like things aren't the same. And I think people are trying to wrap their heads around that, too, because this is happening in a pandemic. It's not just, you know, it can't be apples to apples to 2006. Like, it's just a normal year. But why is there an uptick in violence? Everyone is really looking at the idea that there is a pandemic too. I mean, there's a lot of stressors with money. Jan Michelle Lemon Kearney, I do keep going back. She talked about people being cooped up with nothing to do, and it's leading to heated tensions. And so there's a lot of like social issues behind all of this. It is not. And you know, Chief Elliot Isaac said this yesterday. He's like, this isn't just for the police. I forget what his exact quote was, and it was a succinct sentence. But don't just look at the police. He understands they have a role and they're important. And he was in the hot seat yesterday. You think we put guests in the hot seat? He had to sit in that room and with, you know, council members firing questions at him on really difficult subjects. And he said, I need the help from these neighborhoods. I need more. And he said, I'm not sitting here asking you, council, for money. He's like, but you have to fund some of these other things that are going to help the police. And so that's kind of really what came out of yesterday.
That's interesting because, you know, you talk about the large gatherings, you know, in parks and hey, what's going into even that? Hey, I mean, people gather in parks during warm weather any other year, right? And so is it that there are more people gathering in parks now because there's less to do and people are cooped up at home and inside? And it's like, oh, okay, our favorite theater or, you know, bar or whatever is closing early or is not open at all, or places where we used to go aren't reopened. They're like, hey, this is the only place we kind of have to go to get away from home.
Spreading more quickly on social media. There's a factor there. Things are being videoed for social media and they're spreading more quickly. Like, it's easier than ever to say, we're going to have a large gathering at the bank, everybody come down, because it's just spreading like wildfire on social media. And so that's playing into it. There's no easy answers here.
Yeah. Well, I know you'll keep tabs on this and keep covering it, among so many other things you cover at City Hall, and Cam Knight from our office too covers police. So keep checking Cincinnati.com for Sherry and Cam's coverage of this. I think it's time to bring in our special guest, Sherry. What do you think?
Definitely. I've done some interviews with him in recent weeks, but let's have a chat.
Okay, sounds great. Let's bring in Ryan Messer. All right, special guest time here on the That's So Cincinnati podcast. Pleased to welcome back to the podcast Vice President of the Cincinnati Public Schools Board, Ryan Messer. Ryan, how are you?
I'm doing well, Jason.
It's great to hear your voice again. I hadn't talked to you in a while. Lots to talk about today. Let's jump right into it. Schools. You come at this not only as a member of the school board, but also the father of three children. What is this like for you? And what you know, just kind of give us a feel for the decision and how you're handling this and how you handled the decision that around CPS.
Well, you know, I as you said, I wear two hats. You know, I don't know that we felt we had an option of how we had to start the school year, just given where we were trending as a county in the data that would be informing our decision, looking at numbers of new infections, et cetera. So, you know, I think that was one of those that we had to make the best decision based on the data we had. And that was, we were trending north in number of new infections, et cetera. And then of course, now I put on my parent hat and I'm in day three of homeschool.
Yeah.
And it's not easy. You know, I give kudos to our teachers. They've been fantastic and they got us ready. But anybody that's ever worked with technology knows you can have a technology problem. And real world today, I was supposed to be on an 8 o'clock work conference call that I was leading. But starting at 7:30, I was unable to get my daughter connected to her Google Meet. So I had to send a message to my work friends and say, look, I'm going to be late and try to figure this out. And finally got her up and running and then joined my meeting. And, you know, the good news is my employer, Johnson & Johnson, is really good top down that, you know, we just all have to thrive in this crazy world together and give each other kind of that flexibility. But it's not easy. No question about that.
Not at all.
We're all on a huge learning curve here.
Yeah. And, you know, you think about the diversity of our district. So, A, I get to work from home. So I was there to be able to help out. It wasn't like I was, you know, at a manufacturing facility somewhere or working, you know, as one of our teachers, for example, who are actually leading, you know, this education. So I'm home. And as you know, my husband stays at home, but he's got a 16-month-old that he's trying to take care of, get fed and keep occupied while he's running back and forth between a preschooler and a kindergarten on an iPad sitting in two different parts of the house. Yeah. I mean, it is, and we have it easy. So So I think about a single parent, or I think about a grandparent who's raising their kids. What an interesting time we're in, for sure.
Who has to go, and people who actually, there's not an option of working from home. I do feel very lucky with that myself, but not everyone has that option. They have to go into their workspaces,
right,
and they're not home. I did want to talk to you too about the idea of making a decision like this. We asked the mayor when he was on, when you ran for mayor, did you think I'm going to be making like possibly the biggest decision ever to, affect the lives of Cincinnati citizens? And he said that did weigh on him, like as a mayor, but as a school, when you're running for mayor, you would, there's big decisions to be made there that affect entire cities. But when you ran for school board, were you thinking about education, or, could you have imagined making a decision like this?
No, not at all. And, I think the thing I did think about a lot is ensuring that whatever we do at CPS gives the best possible outcomes for children, no matter where they sit in our district. And I've made a little bit of name for myself in that regard, in that I have visited some of our schools, or I've prioritized right when I joined the board, the schools that really nobody's heard about in our district. And in a couple cases, fully transparent, I didn't feel like they were the CPS experience that you would get in other parts of our district, and, worked with the administration to get some of those changes done, all in the focus of making sure that no matter what seat you're in, you have the opportunity to succeed. Now I'm trying to make a decision with that same lens. No matter what your family situation, that you have the opportunity to succeed. And this is the one that, frankly, is keeping me up all night, because I don't think that every child has the same opportunities that my kids do, just because we have two parents that are at least home helping kind of manage, and not every kid has that. So we have that side. But the other part, as I ran for the district, was, leading one of the largest public school districts in the country, the largest in Ohio, fastest growing. And part of that is being an employer for 3,000 teachers and nearly 5,000 total staff. So I also wear the hat of trying to make sure that we're creating the best work environment. And the piece that's keeping me up at night is these two priorities are often in conflict, because having teachers go to work feels very unsafe during these times. Having kids not go to school seems very unsafe during these times. So that's the conflict that we're in.
Can you take us back to and when the original vote was taken, and you voted 4 or 5 days in school, if I'm not mistaken.
That's right.
How take us through that process. I mean, just your thought process. And I can't imagine what that was like. I mean, it had to have been incredibly excruciatingly just difficult to make. Talk about that. And then also, do you look back and say, hey, I'm glad I made my vote was to do that? Or, okay, if I had to do it over again today, you would do it differently. Talk about that.
Yeah, I absolutely stand by that vote. And, when we were in that discussion, I think some people missed the one statement that was probably the most important. What I said is, I think our decision is either we go back or we don't. And if we go back, I'm not any less or more comfortable if we're 3 versus 6 feet. And what I mean by that is, if we had gone back at 3 feet, we could have had all our kids back in our buildings. And that was per the World Health Organization recommendations. Now, some people felt safer having 6 feet. But when you have to space kids that much further, that means only half of our kids can go. So this week, my daughter, for example, would go these 2 days and 3 days at home. And then the other group would come in the other days and they would rotate. And my fear, going back to the fact that everybody's got different situations, when the little girl that's on the same rotation as my daughter sitting next to her is not at school. Let's say she's in a single parent home who works. She's going to be at any number of child care centers who may or may not be doing 6 feet, probably won't. And so now, or because child care is so expensive, if you can even find a seat, she might be with, you know, one church said, hey, we can have up to 100 kids. So now when that girl comes back, she didn't just go home and stay with her parents. She went to a group of 100 kids at a church because that's all they could afford. Now, that girl's been exposed to all 100 of them and bringing back to my daughter. So that's how I got into the, it's either we go back or not. And this three to six to me just didn't make sense. And then
I agree.
Then we set the parameters to say, based on these four criteria or three criteria, this is either we would go back or we wouldn't go back. And, you know, I think we settled on to having this dashboard that's looking at new infections, you know, looking locally, county, and at the state. My company's doing the same thing. And frankly, I manage the Midwest for my part of J&J. Ohio's not been approved to go back to work. Michigan has, but we haven't in Ohio. So, you know, I don't feel like CPS doing anything kind of crazy because J&J also has said Ohio is not ready, although we're trending in a positive direction. I think the other thing, too, is with us going back 5 weeks at the earliest, or at least making that decision to go back, we're going to have lots of other places to benchmark who have gone back. And so did we see spike in cases? What did infections look like in those districts? And definitely look into districts that are like ours, demographics, urban, et cetera. But I think all of that will help us inform our decision in addition to our scorecard.
I do agree with that, like the idea of like looking around at who's doing what, because it has become, school has become so localized with the idea of what is your district doing? You just get emails. I mean, it used to be like these, you know, you would know what all these different districts are doing, but it's become very local for yourself. But I am so curious about these other districts, how they're dealing with it. What's, I mean, all over the country, because it informs what we're doing.
Yeah, and I know Laura, our superintendent, is definitely benchmarking with other similar districts and then looking kind of across our county at all the school options and having that data available, you know, as we're making those decisions. And I found that very helpful. I will say, though, one thing has been interesting. I would get reached out to by other school districts from their board members saying they were anxiously awaiting to find out what CPS was going to do. So we're in some ways, maybe the leader, you know, locally and even across the state. As soon as we announced our virtual for the first 5 weeks, other districts literally the next day started to change and adopt our policy. So I don't think we can underscore the fact that CPS is looked to by other districts for kind of how decisions are made and then what decisions we're making.
So there's another decision coming up, right? So it was first 5 weeks remote learning.
Mm-hmm.
How soon is that decision?
I believe that's the week of the 14th, yes.
Okay, so we have a little 14th. Bit of time to watch the cases. Of course, the governor on Tuesday did put out a big caution about Labor Day. He does not want to see a spike like after we saw of the virus after Memorial Day and 4th of July. And so he threw out the caution. He started yesterday about gatherings for Labor Day.
Yeah. And, you know, that is the absolute fastest way we can get our kids to go back to school is if everybody wears masks. It's not a political statement. It's not anything other than it is at least one of the most effective ways for us to limit the spread of the infections. And I have to say, I've been pleasantly surprised. At the zoo a couple of weeks ago, not so much. Recently, pretty surprised, pleasantly surprised on Sunday. So 4 weeks ago, I went to the zoo and I thought, good Lord, has anybody even heard that we have a pandemic going on? But then I definitely saw a change when I was there on Sunday. So I feel like people are actually taking this more seriously, and I think that's going to be a big help.
Okay, well, I know we're going to be watching to see what happens, and nobody knows. It's a day-by-day thing. Like, you just can't be like, well, here's what I was thinking. I was going to make a decision in 2 weeks. It's like, nope, every day matters in making decisions.
Yeah, and I think it's just, it's, you know, everybody in the community has to look at it. It's always good to put somebody else's hat on when you're looking at decisions. And I encourage everybody to look at it first through a parent, because lots of parents and students, obviously this is first and foremost. But I think the other side is, if you were an employee, would you want to be going in front of 25, 30 kids every day at this stage in the pandemic? And I think that's where we have to root ourselves, is it's the perspective of the employees and the student, and making the best decision based on the data at that time.
Okay, well, you have it's not been a dull summer for you.
No question about that.
Like, I know that has been your primary focus, even as you're trying to remote work and be a parent, like focus on our school district. We had a community conversation 2 weeks ago now with Tom Brenneman. He said some on-air things that sparked a big reaction. And so you penned an op-ed for the Inquirer about that.
Yeah, you know, I was a little shocked in some ways, and not shocked in others. I mean, I think while we have made great progress, and his comment using the word fag publicly, when he thought he had a closed mic and it was a hot mic. And, you know, I think it's when people show you who they are, believe them. But then I also believe in exploring every opportunity for growth and for change. I think it was a little bit of a shocker, you know, associated with our Reds, who have actually made great strides in connecting with the LGBT community in Cincinnati, and just diversity as a whole. And, you know, I don't in any way think he reflects the values of the Reds or Cincinnati. And, you know, it was a faux pas to do it, but he still said it, and he said it with great ease and comfort. You know, my goal is to say, well, how can this turn into a learning opportunity and growth for him and for others?
But you talked about that word being, you know, something that happened to you. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah. I mean, the 30,000 foot view is, I was raised in rural Indiana, as you know, and being gay wasn't something that, was talked about. There were no TV stars or TV shows. It wasn't talked about in mainstream media. And I just realized that I was different. And when I became the governor's fellow for Evan Bayh in Indiana and moved to Indianapolis right after graduation, a couple weeks into that, I went into the Yellow Pages, found where it said gay bar, and decided I was going to go there. I was 21 and was going to go there. It was a not so good part of town. And I didn't make it into the bar that night. I got jumped by these five guys, and I landed in the emergency room and then admitted to the hospital. And it was that word. Obviously, I'd heard that before. I mean, anybody who's gay or even maybe acts, even maybe they're straight and they're just not super macho, they've probably heard it, or they're being called that, you know, just to be made fun of. But it's a word that we'd heard before. But it was that word that I heard right before that first blow to my face. And that always stuck with me. And I used to give these talks as we were trying to pass the Matthew Shepard and James R. Byrd hate crimes bill. Would travel around the country telling my story. And I used that word as just how jarring, you know, that whole experience kind of tied to the word that began that beating. So, you know, it is... not an easy word for me to hear just kind of publicly thrown around.
I really like to, it was a great op-ed, Ryan, and I really like to encourage people to go and read that. Just search your name, Ryan Messer and Tom Brenneman, and the op-ed will pop right up. You also, in that op-ed, the personal story and the personal pain of what you dealt with, you also in the op-ed said, like, you didn't think this should ruin Tom Brenneman. Talk about what your thought process was in writing that as well.
Yeah, I think you always have to start with grace in every situation. And if you just dial back to my personal experience, if I didn't believe that, I wouldn't have a relationship with my father today. My father, farmer, rural Indiana, raised tobacco, cattle, and hogs.
Mm-hmm.
When he was less than thrilled when I came out. And I have seen him go from, you know, I can't accept this. This is just not going to be something that I'm ever going to support, to here we are 20 years later. And when somebody gives a disparaging comment, or a politician's on TV talking about reversing marriage equality, my mother says that he just screams at the TV. That's progress and growth. And so if I didn't believe that, I would never, you know, I had to give my dad that room to grow. Nobody would question that today. He's a fierce advocate for me. He loves Jimmy, my husband. He loves our children. But it didn't start out that way. And, you know, I think if the best way to change somebody's heart and mind is to give them a personal experience with someone. And I have found that powerful to be true with 99% of the people that I've met who may not have been comfortable with somebody being gay, including my boss at J&J. You know, he'd never had anybody on his team that was gay. I remember managing a guy at Johnson & Johnson a few years back, and then when he got promoted, at his going away, he said, I will tell you, as a faith-based man who raised my children in the church and, you know, God is the center of our world, the one thing I will say that Ryan did above being a great boss is give me a broader perspective of people. And, you know, clearly said I was the first gay person he'd ever met and or worked with. And it changed he and his family. That's what it's all about.
Yeah. That's powerful stuff, Ryan. I mean, the fact, just sharing that about your dad and just your relationship and how things have evolved there, and then what you shared in the op-ed, just I can't let people know enough. I think they should really go check that out, and it was really appreciate you writing that.
Yeah, and more to come on this, but I believe Tom will be coming to my house to meet my family on September 12th. Now, how about that?
I have heard that he's reached out to people in the community and saying he wants to learn and better understand things. Have you had a conversation with him?
Well, not directly with him, but I locked in the date at my house on September 12th just yesterday. You know, that's all great. You can expect. If we open more dialogue versus shutting more doors, this world would be a much better place. So I think that'll be a great discussion. Maybe we can have a separate version, like a special edition, where you have Ryan Messer and Tom Brenneman talking about their, you know, their meeting. I think that's
going to be an
interesting dialogue. Yeah.
Done.
I love it. I love you guys getting together.
You've opened your home more. You have talked about like a Leadership Cincinnati moment of having like a group conversation. This is not the first time you've done something like this.
No, I mean, I remember a couple years ago, we've done it a few times, but we had like this incredible dialogue around our dining room table, part of Leadership Cincinnati's diversity series. I was in class 38, the best, grade 38.
Everyone says that about their leadership.
I know, but they weren't in 38, so they can't really say it. But I had, you know, they asked, hey, could you host one of our dinners? There's a group going to a Muslim home. There's a group going to meet with returning citizens. We'd like to have you as the LGBTQ house. And so the short story is there was a local pastor who was part of this group, pastor that maybe believed in conversion therapy, et cetera. And he started off the dialogue kind of waving at, you know, my husband and me, and one of our children was a baby then, probably Lillian. And he said, you know, I'm fundamentally and philosophically opposed to all of this. My question is, can we have that disagreement and go forward? Well, that set us in a fabulous conversation. I wish that could have been recorded because it was fireworks. But the beauty of that is I was told by somebody in that congregation that, like, a few weeks later, he did a sermon. He said, have you ever had those moments where somebody made you question the things that you believed? And he said, I went to this home feeling one thing, and I left feeling something different. So when that person told me, I said, that's exactly why we wanted to do that dinner. And you got to be willing to engage. You got to be willing to have the dialogue and give them space to go from where they are to where maybe others go. And it may not be overnight, but each little step will be progress. You know, few people, I think you could say you'll never change. I really believe that. I think the majority of people, given the environment, the time, the caring, I think they will change.
Well, and it depends on, like, a willingness to learn. I think we've heard that, you know, Evan Millward from Channel 9, the reporter there, he penned his own op-ed, very moving about, you know, when that has happened to him, being called that. And he has talked about talking to Tom Brenneman. And I think the change moments when people have to be willing to learn.
Yeah.
And willing to listen. And that's how change comes about.
Right. And whether, you know, whether it's the discussion on police, whether it's a discussion on Black Lives Matter, whether it's a streetcar. I mean, maybe that's one you'll never be able to get people to the center. But
I was going to say that till the end, but here we go.
Just throw that out there. But yeah, I just think I think it's always worth a conversation. A conversation can never hurt. And sometimes you just have to be willing to be open and send an invitation. And so I think it's going to be a great story. I really believe this will be a positive outcome.
And we haven't heard from the Reds yet. You know, Tom Brenneman is off the air. We didn't say that. He's off the air right now. And they're just, I think they said they're reviewing things and talking internally about things.
Yeah.
All right. So you brought it up.
And I think the other nuance here, not everybody will attach the same emotion to a word that somebody else might. And I mean, yes, the word, hey, you faggot. I mean, we've all heard that. And it's not just used against gay people, but it's, you know, yes, it's kind of condescending to gay people. At the same time, if you're not gay, you can't understand the meaning. And that's okay. And that's where the conversation comes in. I guarantee you, he understands how that word makes others feel. He will never allow that in his presence again. I used to hear that word at work at J&J. Today, if it was heard, I don't think they'd be at work on Monday. So my company has evolved even in the recent 5 years.
Hey, Ryan, I want to ask you, I want to add one more thing before we jump over into some other topics. And I want to read this for the listeners, and then I want to ask you a question after of it. And this is a line from your op-ed. I don't want to see Tom Brenneman's life ruined because of this incident. Perhaps there is some good that can come of it if he comes to understand the pain that word has caused throughout history. The question I want to ask you is, do you think Tom Brenneman should be fired?
I don't.
Okay.
Unless he says, which I don't think this is going to be the case, he says, no, I can use that word. Who cares? It's just a word. No. Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's not going to be the case here. Just in everything that I've seen, I don't think he should be fired. I think the good that can come out of this is, mm-hmm. you know, the thing about the LGBTQ community has made great strides in 10 years. I mean, just in my, so I came out in 95 and got beaten up. So here we are a few years later. Just the difference in what's happened. Well, the progress didn't happen because it was only gay people pushing it. There have been allies and people who joined the coalition, who all work together to kind of help make the change. And frankly, the people who can make the most change are the people who have changed the most. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it makes
people who can make the most change of those, and they can be the ones that others look to and say, guys, you know why this is wrong? Guess what I learned. I know we throw it away, you know, as just, it seems like another, like, you idiot, you stupid, you fag, whatever. Let me give you what I've learned about that word.
I mean, Tom Brenneman has such a platform, and obviously his team, and it's for your, what you're saying is he can really turn this into a real positive here and become, because of who he is and his platform, a real advocate for change and for continuing to change. And I made this mistake, and now look where I'm at, and look what he's doing to help.
Yeah, because the only alternative we have is, oh, fire him, send him off, sit in a corner somewhere. Nobody hears from him. So, hey, so you say this, you get fired. It's like, punch somebody in the face. That's it. Done. Versus giving the opportunity. Again, I think some of the most fierce advocates in whatever topic may not be those the most effective, but it's people who have learned and empathize.
Yeah.
And again, I start with my father. And that was a perfect example that if I used the logic, he should be fired. Then years ago, I would have just written my father off and never talked to him again. And I see these as similar.
Great stuff. If we can jump to this other, a couple more things we wanted to ask you about. So much going on right now. And I want to just turn this over to Sherry on the Airbnb. On the Airbnb stuff, she's been covering it and has followed it. And so I want to let her kind of ask you about that.
You know, 2 weeks ago, I mean, I have written a lot about this. 2 weeks ago, we had the shooting of a handyman trying to break up an Airbnb party. And, you know, I kind of heard that in passing and I'm looking to write about it. And you and I have talked in the past because you own Airbnb units.
Yeah.
About what's going on with these pandemic parties. I had heard that shooting was like, that seemed to me right away as an offshoot of what we had been hearing. And when I called you and we really talked about it, I couldn't believe what you were telling me. Talk about kind of what you've experienced this summer.
Yeah. You know, I got experience with Airbnb just as a traveler, you know, with four kids. It's hard to squeeze into a hotel room. And even if you can do it, it's just not comfortable, especially with a 16-month-old who may not sleep the whole night, kids that flip and turn and the whole bit. And so Airbnbs, you can kind of get a place to spread out. So I think it's especially good for family. So we had a property in Over the Rhine that, having lived there, we invested in, and we completely invested over our heads and well over the values. We had to do pylons and everything underneath. So in trying to rent it, we had some issues. So somebody said, you should try Airbnb. So we did. We actually had zero issues until we did the first one, which was in the pandemic. And we'd been, I think it'd been up and running like 4 months before that. So during, right after the pandemic, you know, a woman rented it, said it was for her and her two daughters, something like that, but it was very nebulous. And so they checked in, no worries. But the day of their checkout, I got a message from one of the neighbors and said, hey, I think you should check on the property. There was some activity last night, and I think you should be aware. So I called the person immediately, and she basically said, I can't believe you're even asking about this. In fact, she said, you know, I believe, are you trying to be racist here? And I said, no, I'm truly just asking. Here's the facts I got from a neighbor. Were there gunshots and were there police in front of the house? Absolutely not. Absolutely not. So as soon as they checked out, went there to find about $20,000 worth of damage, as it turned out, with the television stolen, dressers stolen, artwork stolen, the Keurig stolen. And so, you know, after having issues already with trying to get it rented and just trying to get cost neutral on this property to see all that damage, it was horrible. So I went through the work to capture with photos, costs of replacement, all the things, and put it into a spreadsheet. And, you know, the next morning, which was Monday, contacted Captain Gregory, who was responsible for the district for Cincinnati Police, where the property sits. And after really getting little to no response, and ultimately having to have somebody in a completely different part of Cincinnati Police do my report, finally, after a lot of pushing, got a detective assigned to it. Now, when we found out that the property had been damaged, the girl who rented it, turns out she rented it for her brother or cousin, which I think it evolved into. And when I let her know that all the damage had happened and all the things were stolen, she said, "Oh, I don't have any money. You cannot do this to me. I'm going to give you who it is." So she gave me the names of the individuals, their addresses, their phone numbers, and said that the one had live streamed all the wreckage and partying and everything on their Facebook. So I went on there, and sure enough, there they are in the house with guns, drugs, alcohol, kind of just a mess. So I had screenshots of that video, which he subsequently took down. But I provided all this information, the names, the address, phone numbers, photographs, and then even had a neighbor who watched all this, because then another neighbor across the street said, "Hey, I saw them carry things out of your house." And what was I told by Cincinnati Police? It's a civil matter. And they sent me packing. So that started our negative experiences. And so we began after that patrolling our property every night just in case something happened. And we were good for another several weeks. And then we had another incident. And that's the one where my husband went in because there was obviously loud music happening, knocked on the door. And it turned violent pretty quickly, where he had his life threatened. And we called 911. That was about 30 minutes before anybody showed. I hopped down in my boxer shorts, hopped in the car, and got there before the police did. Fortunately, at that point, everybody scrammed. Didn't feel like there was a whole lot of support that time either. So I think the narrative that people are allowing these and not doing anything is absolutely wrong. Nobody I know wants to have $20,000 in damage because of one of these parties. And a party is going to do some damage to the properties. And if you go and look at Airbnb, these are nice places.
I mean, everything's top notch. We heard, you know, David Mann, he authored the Airbnb rules and regulations for the city. And so much at the time was focused on, should there be a fee put towards affordable housing if we're going to do this? And that was really the narrative around it. But there are rules and regulations, and he's kind of focused on that in all of this. We have heard the police chief say, you know, these parties are out of hand, we need to crack down on them. But then you hear David Mann talk about the owners taking responsibility. I know that was very frustrating to the owners I've talked to.
Yeah, and I love David. I think in this one, he's wrong in that he said, you know, even on the radio this week, "Hey, I'm not against the people who are taking care of them. I want to crack down the ones who aren't." And my pushback to that is, I don't know anybody, not one. And there's a local organization of people who have Airbnbs. Not one wants any party, not even one. So I think what that group is saying, we want to be able to have the people who violate, you know, because they have to say how many people they're coming and bringing to a property. And all of us use a similar template. So if you reserve it with two adults, two kids, it says this booking is for two adults, two kids. No one else is to be on the property without first notifying the landlord in receiving written permission for additional people. All of us have that in there. So all these extra people are above and beyond what they're even allowed to. But we have no recourse. And then when there is something and somebody does all this damage and has guns and the whole bit, and we provide pictures, we're told it's a civil matter. Good luck. So, you know, I think that's the issue here is, you know, if there is anybody out there who's abusing it, sure, take them to task. I'll help. But for the people who are following the rules, you know, I think we have to figure out then when something goes wrong, how do we work together to make sure that we break these up before they turn deadly?
So you had that initial frustration with the police saying it was a civil matter, but this is a huge conversation in City Hall right now. You do feel like you've gotten some response, though?
Yeah. Well, I happen to know the guy tangentially. I've met him a few times who got shot. And so it really got close to home. I mean, you know, gun violence. I was talking to my friend Ozzy Davis about like this whole gun violence. What's going on? How do we do? But it wasn't personal.
Ozzy, a community activist in Avondale. Hi, Ozzy.
Yeah. So somebody who's a good friend of mine who we often talk about issues like this. You know, I think it got a little personal when I found out one of the shootings of a woman in Avondale might have been because she was gay and didn't present as a, you know, effeminate woman, et cetera. So that's,
we did see an arrest in that this week.
I did see that. I think Inquirer reported on that right after yesterday. The other one, which happened to be a guy that I knew, was the first person I've known to be shot, in Cincinnati, personally. And so it hit a little home and, you know, I decided like, wait a minute. So we're having all this conversation. David sent a motion through. Guys, let's go back and look at what happened. Like, here is a case. I did all the work for you. People said I should be in a detective because I laid out photograph, name, address, and proof with the photos that they were in the property with guns, etc. The one guy then posted even recently with a semi-automatic rifle. And this is a young guy in Cincinnati who, and then we found out he had done a couple more Airbnbs after ours. And guess what? Nothing happened. So I decided to resurface that email. And this time, sent it to Captain Gregory. I copied it to city council and the mayor. And that was on Friday. And I will say, I definitely got response that people are looking into it. And I haven't heard anything other than that people were looking into it. We're now several days past that. But I'm hopeful that something is being done and maybe they'll let me know in the not too distant future.
Yeah, and then we're looking to see what's going to happen with that case. You know, there's it's investigation underway into the shooting of Stephen Knight. And the Inquirer is going to keep reporting on these things because it's been a lot during the pandemic. I mean, and it really was even cited in the chief's letter. Jason and I talked about this at the beginning of the episode. It was cited in the chief's letter to the mayor and ultimately to the governor of like these parties. We have to do something about it. And so, I feel like the Airbnb report after the last month, but these are important issues in the city because it's happening.
Yeah. And whether it's because of curfew or whether it's because, let's say, the one that happened at our house in March, the guy was live streaming on Facebook in this beautifully redone home with back terraces overlooking the city and over the Rhine, drinking, guns, you name it, going on. And then they walked away with a couple flat screen TVs, some furniture, some artwork, and nothing happened. All the 4,999 people that we showed that were on his Facebook, nobody thought anything wrong with that. And so did they see that and say, well, then heck, oh, wait a minute, he did it again 2 weeks later. And then he did it again. Well, maybe I'm going to do that. And so by not doing anything, have we created a culture that's made these parties more prevalent here than I've heard anywhere else in the country? And I think the police have to take some responsibility for that. What you permit, you promote. And they permitted these parties. They permitted somebody to steal and take personal belongings and completely damage a brand new renovated property and let him go and didn't do a thing about it and sent me packing saying it was a civil matter. So I believe if they've allowed these, they're promoting them. And that's, I believe, how the word has gotten out, at least in part.
No, I do agree with that. And I know that there was some live streaming going on at the party where the shooting happened. And so this is definitely, it's spreading on social media and it's probably fueling it. Like, social media is probably a whole other conversation on all the things that happen there.
Yeah.
And play out there.
But I think if they dig into a few of these and people are held accountable, like the one that did the destruction at our property, word will also get out. And that's the number one way, I think, that we're going to stop these. Because, again, as I said, I don't know a single person who has the Airbnb. You know, we're getting ready to sell that property, thankfully, in 2 weeks from Tuesday. So cross our fingers. Nevertheless, I don't know anybody who wants these parties on their property. So at least we have that in our favor. So now if we say, hey, and anybody who tries it, we're going to treat them just like we would any other crime and hold them accountable, I believe we'll put a huge dent into limiting these going forward.
That's what I told him was going to happen, but we'll be watching for that.
Hey, Ryan, real quick before we go, streetcar, yet another political fight over that. What's just your overall take on this ongoing battle over the streetcar seven and a half years later?
Oh my gosh.
Years from the opening.
Yeah. I mean, it could not get any more painful to people out in the public. Yeah. I was a supporter of it being built. We realized, as you know, we've heard in the Inquirer and other places across the country, other cities are getting federal grants to do expansions. I think a lot of people who may not have been huge advocates said, well, but if it goes to Uptown, I mean, now that would be really big. So there's that whole camp. Now, we haven't done any of those Tiger grants. And I think, you know, the mayor says, hey, this was not a good thing for me. I ran against it. Didn't feel good to lose on the subject. You know, I think when you're a leader, sometimes you have to say, you know what, may not be what I have wanted, but now I'm responsible and I'm going to make the most of it. And I think this one, it has just gotten into his skin and just like he cannot think of anything else other than it. And I think about what if we spent the time we've spent on the streetcar, just human time, brain time, public meetings. If we dedicated that to fixing shooting deaths, fixing poverty, fixing whatever, has to be a bigger priority than continuing to just to soak up all the energy in these meetings for something that we already decided on. And it should be make it work. Other cities are making it work. I haven't found a single other city where it's not working, except Cincinnati. And I believe it's just because we have some personal vendettas that just have not been settled. And I frankly think a lot of this is going to go away after the next election.
I mean, yesterday we saw Greg Landsman turn to the mayor during a special session of the council for the phone call, say, I think your superpower is opposing this project. He was visibly upset that the conversation is still going on about these simple votes to just run the streetcar.
Yeah, and I think you can argue one way or the other. That will be what he's going to be known for when he's not mayor anymore. And did he stop it? No. Did he cause lots of problems and take the focus of from other issues? Yeah. And maybe he doesn't care that becomes his legacy. But, you know, I think I remember just hearing people, God forbid Mark Mallory try to use the veto as much as John Cranley has. How many times has he used that versus every other mayor before? I'd be interested to know that. but, you know, I saw a post yesterday on social media that just said cancel culture. How many times has this mayor used the veto power to go against people in his own party and go against people in the community? I think that's interesting. I'd be curious to know how many vetoes he's done versus others. But unfortunately,
it's like you're assigning me a story. Fine, Ryan.
I think that's a good one.
Fine.
But I think it's time to turn the page. And unfortunately, we can't turn the page until November of 2021. But then I think it's going to get some people in the room to say, okay, we have this asset. The federal government has invested a lot of money. And we put in local money as well. A, how do we fix the funding on a permanent basis? I think that should be done. It shouldn't be down at budget time. And there's like all these, I feel like there's coconut shells and I can't keep up who, what's in what shell. And it's being moved around. I'm like, boom, we got a solution. That doesn't feel good for me. So I would rather have a big conversation on how do we make the current version of the streetcar a success, and how do we start to organize with people who are in leadership in Uptown, with the institutions, academic institutions, universities, et cetera, who back when I was involved in the initial conversation about the streetcar were excited about it coming uphill, getting a plan to say, let's make that happen and get us in line for those federal dollars. So instead of Kansas City getting another $50 million, Cincinnati's getting another $50 million, and we have an expansion. Nothing's more painful to watch than these constant expansions of 71 and 75. And, you know, the way I have always viewed the streetcar is it gets a nucleus within our city to be able to navigate our city, but there ultimately will be a day where we have to do some sort of mass transit to the airport, to the eastern suburbs, the western suburbs, the northern suburbs, like other major cities have invested. So to me, there is a much broader, longer plan conversation needs to happen, but only after we get a good, solid plan for how we operate the investment that we've made today.
So we're going to watch for this week to see what happens with this and hopefully have it runs free and problem free and we move on from this conversation. I'm not sure that's where we're headed, but that's the
And then can we go back to the gun violence, please? Let's turn the page back to gun violence, managing this pandemic, figuring out a way to get our kids back to school. You know, I think, you know, things like the digital divide, and there's big things in our city that need to be addressed. And I think like digital divide has come up because of the schools and kids having access, but there's also seniors who don't have access to the internet to do virtual doctor's appointments, putting themselves in more harm than, say, my parents who are doing their doctor's appointments virtually down on the farm in Rising Sun. These are bigger issues that I think can help our city versus constantly stirring on some of these
Definitely.
Other topics.
Great stuff.
I'll refer everyone to Jason's column from this week.
Oh, good.
Hey, great stuff, Ryan. Really, really appreciate you taking the time to come back on the podcast and discuss all these different topics and issues, and really, really enjoyed it.
It's always good to talk to you both.
Thanks, Ryan.
Thank you.
Bye, Ryan.
All right. Thanks again to Ryan Messer. Always enjoy chatting with Ryan. Now let's talk about some fun things, Sherry. So that means maybe we should talk about the Steve Chabot, Kate Schroeder race. That's a lot of fun right now. Does that fit the fun segment? I'm kidding.
No, I'm good. I do want to encourage everyone to read Scott Wortman, our reporter who's covering that race. He did a deep dive into one of the ad watches from Chabot's campaign. And it's basically like a campaign story of like all the issues in that race. He spent a lot of time on that. I helped him a little bit behind the scenes, all the claims in that ad. I encourage people to go take a look at that because it says a lot about what's going on in that race. Not the fun segment. I think that we should change the name of the fun segment to the outdoor segment. And it's going to get harder as we go along here.
Oh, yes. What do you, you always have something fun. You've always done something cool because you get out and do different things around town. Anything, do anything fun over the weekend?
It does take a lot of planning. I'm not going to lie. But when I was looking around for things to do, it was one of my friend's birthdays. And you know, those things, they just pop up on Facebook, right? All the things you've done in years past with my same group of friends. And it's like, wow, those are things we're all inside. So this year, when I looked around, I really hit upon it. It ended up being a lovely event. The Red Door Project, it's like this pop-up art shows. And all over town since 2014, it's hosted by Barbara Hauser, a downtown resident. She kind of put it together so you could get to know new artists and see the artwork. And so they had it outdoors at the Art Climb outside of the Cincinnati Art Museum. And it was a really fun night, just kind of climbing the steps. You know, the sun is setting. You can kind of look over the city. And so we did that, and we wore masks outside. It was a masked event outside. It was still a really good time.
I was you're always exploring new things. I was going to say I would never thought that's what you were going to say that you did. I appreciate that about you, and I hope that our listeners appreciate that. Like, that if you want to try different things around town, listen to the fun segment of the show, because Sherry's always got something that she's found.
So interesting. After we went to this, we went to Maze downtown to do some outdoor dining. And Maze is one of the ones where they have a street closed off next to it with the barriers. I think this is a conversation that's really going to start. You know, these were supposed to be like temporary street closures. These were a huge deal in the spring, right, to help these restaurants that weren't allowed to open inside dining, to, you know, help them reopen and help them get clients. And I've done a couple of these, you know, sitting on the streets with the barriers. And I think we're going to start seeing, you know, how extended these really are going to be in these alleyways. And some of them have tents and, you know, stringed lights over the alleys. And they're very popular, and they're a way to go outside, which I know not everyone's even really doing that, because some people still see that as gathering, but it's kind of like a nice medium of being able to go out. And it'll be interesting to see if, you know, are council going to make these, you know, permanent? Like, what are these going to look like, especially going into winter? Will they shut down in the winter? Are there going to be heaters? They're very much a part of the downtown area now. So I'm not looking for to kind of see what happens with all of those, because it has proved popular.
That's it. And I'd totally forgotten about that, but you see a push at City Hall to make that permanent. I guess it involves parking and like taking parking revenue away and stuff like that. So I'm
it
sure
it doesn't, and I haven't heard too much, but I, you know, where this is really, I mean, from 3CDC. Is really, they're like the landlords of a lot of these restaurants in the areas.
Mm-hmm.
You know, say what you want about the gentrification of Over the Rhine and the redoing of it. A lot of money has been poured into Over the Rhine to make it is what it is. It's been hailed internationally for what's happened there. And there is a lot of thought right now being put into preserving, you know, all of that investment, and not just, you know, letting everything kind of slide into like a pandemic closures and helping these restaurants, and it's the entertainment district now. And so these conversations, I think, are going to continue on how to do this and not just let kind of things languish.
Great stuff. Add another potential story or thing to ask about, or keep your eye out on at City Hall, Sherry, because I know that that list is long and it grows constantly. Hey, everyone, thanks again for your support of this podcast. I'd like to point out it was 2 years ago in the upcoming week. Really, it was 2 years ago this week. It was the first week of September when we launched That's So Cincinnati podcast. And here we are still 2 years later. And it's because of you, our listeners, your support. You've helped this podcast to grow. Certainly as we've had to make some adjustments as we record this on a 3-4 way phone call now, at least for the past several months. And I know the sound quality has not been as good, but you've continued to listen. And I can just assure you, like, hey, when we can get back into our studio and record, we will be in there as soon as we can. But thank you so much for continuing to support us on this podcast. Check us out on Twitter at Sharon Coolidge, at Jay Williams Cincy, and don't hesitate to shoot us emails either. jwilliams@inquire.com, scoolidge@inquire.com. Appreciate your feedback. Appreciate Bruce's email last week, fact-checking some things in last week's episode with Jane Temkin, the Ohio GOP chair. And so, hey, we want to hear your feedback. If you hear something in an interview that you're like, I don't think that was factually correct, let us know. Or you liked it or you didn't like it, let us know. That's how we improve this podcast. So, thanks so much, and we'll catch you next week. All right. Let's go.
Okay.